Welcome to the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast with your host, Dr. Yoni Rosenblad. Today, we delve into the specialized world of evaluating and treating overhead athletes with Dr. John Harnett. In this insightful session, Dr. Harnett shares his expertise and practical strategies for optimizing performance and preventing injuries in athletes who rely heavily on overhead movements. Join us as we explore the unique biomechanical challenges faced by overhead athletes, from baseball pitchers to volleyball players and tennis professionals. Dr. Harnett discusses comprehensive evaluation techniques, effective treatment protocols, and injury prevention strategies tailored specifically for this athletic population. Whether you're a sports physical therapist, coach, or athlete, this episode offers valuable insights into understanding the demands placed on overhead athletes and implementing evidence-based approaches to enhance their performance and longevity in their sport. Let's jump right in.
Hey guys, welcome back and thanks for joining us on the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast. Today we have Dr. John Harnett, and we got a conversation that really dives into the overhead athlete, not just baseball, but anyone who lives with their arms up over their head for their sport. And we get into pretty simple stuff like ranges of motion and manual muscle testing and special testing when you're looking at evaluating this type of athlete. But John does a great job of really getting into the nitty-gritty of specifics per sport. So we talk about the baseball athlete and types of ranges of motion that you would see there, how that differs from a quarterback or any other type of thrower. How much import does he put on special tests in terms of diagnosis? Does it matter what the actual pathology is? John really does a great deep dive. This is a great conversation if you are either a baseball aficionado and you're seeing baseball players all day. He really gives you some tips and some wisdom as to how to approach that sport. But also, a lot of times we'll see sports physical therapists that specialize in the field athletes, be it lacrosse or soccer, and they get thrown with a shoulder and they're kind of like a fish out of water. John does a great job of boiling it down to digestible information that you can use tomorrow to make yourself a better physical therapist and treat that overhead athlete and really allow your patients to excel under your care. That's what we're about in the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast world. We're just trying to get you better at treating your athlete. There's a lot of wisdom here. I look forward to everyone's feedback. Share this conversation with PTs, with physios, with chiros, with athletic trainers that could benefit from this knowledge. Let us know what you think. We're super accessible. Shoot us a DM on Instagram, TrueSportsPT. We'd love to hear your feedback. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. John Harnett. Dr. Jonathan Harnett, good to see you. Thanks for making time. Welcome to your first of hopefully many appearances on the True Sports Physical Therapy Podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be on. Took a little bit, but I'm glad we're here.
Took way too long. Part of it is I'm so sick and tired of having guests on that make my hair game look horrible. Your hair game, for those who are not watching, looks way worse than mine. No, it looks unbelievable. So just try not to make me look too bad, Harnett. And keep the ink under the screen. That also makes me look pale.
There's a lot of tools when it comes to that hair product, though, so we can get into that at a later date. It's a science.
Not on this pod. That's not where you're going to find your hair information, for those of you listening. I wanted to get into some of your baseball expertise. Your background is actually fascinating. So I want you to get a little bit into what brought you to True Sports currently. What have you been through and what did you go through? I'd love to hear about your residency experience or lack thereof and how you ended up where you are. So let's start there.
For sure. So I graduated PT school at Lebanon Valley College near Hershey, Pennsylvania, a small town called Annville. Played baseball there. Always knew I wanted to do, sports rehab. Kind of got accepted into the Johns Hopkins Sports Residency down here in Maryland. So that's what brought me here. So I moved June of 2020, which was COVID year. So that was a challenge in itself, trying to navigate a start date with residency that kept getting pushed back. And then navigating things changing within the program, obviously, because the country was shut down. I heard about True Sports and was following the Instagram, prior to graduating, mainly because of, Andrew Livingston. He graduated 2 or 3 years ahead of me. Always knew I wanted, to go into the sports world. Had a rotation with the Cleveland Indians, now Guardians. So I knew I wanted to do that, have a baseball focus and whatnot. And I thought to myself, if the date keeps getting pushed back. Like, do I necessarily need that if I'm going to be able to obtain everything I want out of a residency with a company? And that, for me, that looked like facilities, having top-notch facilities in order to partake in sports rehab, mentorship, which I'm still getting to this day, which is awesome. So it all just checked the boxes. So I went out a limb, I turned down the residency, and now we're here. And that was probably one of the best decisions I think I've made in my life so far in career.
Yeah, I think the conversation around residency has changed over the last few years as private practices have been able to keep up with some of what you mentioned, why people would look towards a residency. Mentorship, I know here at True Sports, we're able to now provide a robust offering as far as mentorship. Facilities, people are able to open up shops, be in cutting edge facilities like we are in the strength and conditioning performance world. That used to only be in the college setting. Right. So I think people are really beginning to look past residency. It's a worthwhile conversation. We've covered it here on the pod a number of times. I think you are an awesome resource to talk through that with applicants. So usually we wait till the end of the pod, but I think it's worthwhile tell everyone how they can find you, and if that's a conversation worth having, how they can get a hold of you.
So yeah, usually Instagram is the best. So it's @diamond_doctor, as in DR, and then 1-4. So diamond, like a little diamond or a baseball diamond. So that's getting my little play on Instagram. You can just DM me, ask any questions you want, collaborate. That's usually the easiest.
Yeah, and you're really great on there with a bunch of information. You're super accessible there. So let's dive right in. Walk me through how you would summarize your initial evaluation of the injured thrower, whether it be pitcher or quarterback or otherwise.
I think obviously, and you know, you learn this in school, and you know, everyone, you know, talks about it. I think the biggest things that we can, you know, have to offer is get a really good subjective. Especially with a thrower, like the shoulders are very mobile joint. So there's already a ton degrees of freedom. Where are they feeling pain when they're throwing? Is it on ball release? Is it in layback, which is pretty much just max external rotation? Where are they feeling it when they raise your arm and things like that? Or, you know, describe that pain. Is it in the front of the shoulders, in the side? Is it in the back? Is it kind of like scap? So I think really forming a very strong subjective leads you to what you're going to do in your exam. And that's pretty much for anything that you have with any patient. If I'm looking at this athlete, regardless of, you know, position and stuff like that, I'm looking at how his shoulder is sitting. That's like number one for me. Is it anteriorly positioned in his glenoid? So meaning like, is his shoulder just kind of forward from more that neutral position? Is it rounded? Does it look like it's being tucked in? I'm looking at how his scapula is sitting, you know, in relation to his the center of his spine. Is it abducted? Is it already upwardly rotated? A lot of times you're going to see some form of scap issue, especially in your younger athletes, but even in like your high school, college, and up into the pros. And a lot of times that's, you know, a telltale sign of maybe what could be causing that shoulder pain. So your basic observations. I'm also having them do just like a freestanding screen of, you know, 90-90 ER, IR, how much layback do they have? You know, maybe they're getting pain actively. Maybe I take them passively into that. Maybe they're not getting pain. You're kind of looking at all that.
And how, what do you look, when you do standing IR, ER in a 90-90 position, what are you considering normal at this point?
So I would like to see, and again, it's dependent. If you have a pitcher and things like that, you're going to need a lot more external rotation than maybe an infielder or an outfielder. Ideally, you know, in a position player, I'm looking for 100, maybe more, things like that. In a pitcher, I'm looking for a little bit more than that. Obviously, when you take your measurements, you want your total arc to be around the same. And then obviously we know in throwers and stuff like that, you're going to be losing some form of internal rotation with an external rotation gain.
Right.
So eyeball measurement, I'm looking for, are they able to pretty much get it past their like scapular position? I'm also looking for, is there excess, you know, thoracic spine extension? Are we cheating through that to get that and make the illusion we have it? A lot of the times you're going to see that. So it could be something as easy as, let's stand up against the wall, make sure there's, you know, space, you know, on the right arm or left arm, depending what they're doing. And now let's get into it and see how much we actually have.
Yeah. I think that's worthwhile. I think that doesn't necessarily show up in textbooks or in school. Like, people will look like they have 110, 120 degrees of shoulder external rotation, but there's a tremendous amount of lordosis, or there's just compensation from elsewhere. So teasing that out. You mentioned when you're going through the subjective, hey, I feel it on ball release, I feel it on layback, or whenever they're saying they feel it, if they are able to identify it, how does that change your objective and then intervention?
So if they're feeling more on layback or on ball release, it could just be different tissues that are being stressed. If they're kind of getting it on like layback, which is a lot of the times what I will see, especially in your younger athlete and stuff like that, it's one of two things. And obviously, like, your exam is going to show you and things like that. It's either one, they don't have like enough external rotation, so they're just kind of forcing it back or jamming it back there to make up for that. Or if they do, they don't have that end range control or end range stability or strength in that position. Yeah. And therefore you can be getting some, you know, posterior impingement and things like that. On ball release and stuff like that, it also like depends on where they're getting it. Sometimes if they're having some anterior shoulder pain, you know, again, you're looking at their total range of motion. If they don't have enough ER and they're getting anterior pain on ball release or anterior pain in general, maybe we're just getting anterior structures involved on the shoulder that are trying to do too much or compensate and things like that.
Yeah. Now part of this is, it could be my bias because I'm not the brightest guy, but it basically boils down to, if it's tight, you're going to notice hypomobility, you're going to stretch it. If it's loose and floppy, you're going to encourage stability and strength. So why ask them these questions as to when they feel it through their motion?
I think because then that's going to lead you to where, other than the basics in which your rehab, you know, in your plan of care that you're going to create, right? A lot of the times, if it's the stability issue, you're going to start with your, you know, your basic rotator cuff stuff and build up a good base. Like, you crush the basics really well, but then, you know, all right, they always get it on ball release or they always get it in layback. You're going to structure those secondary interventions after you build that good base in order to attack that issue.
Okay, so give me an example of that. What are those secondary interventions?
So if you're, let's say you have an athlete, they're getting it in layback. You find that they have a super weak cuff, so you're hammering, like, let's say your sideline dumbbell ER, your tubing, other external rotation exercises. Say it's a super young athlete, so they don't, you know, they've never done arm care, they've never strengthened their shoulder and stuff like that. You build up that base foundation. Now you're like, all right, let's tackle end range stability or, you know, strength and layback and max ER. Maybe you're in a half kneeling position up against the wall and you're doing kind of like these ER peel offs, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm applying a posterior force to your wrist or your forearm, and you're trying to keep it there. You're trying to get it off as far as you can. Same concept. You're in prone, you're on your stomach. You have a weighted ball. You're in a 90-90 position and you're coming off into that last little bit of end range. If you can't get it, I'm assisting you to get there. And then, all right, let's hold this, boom. And then let's rip into that range. So you're just putting them in a position of either full external rotation in that throwing position, that 90-90 or super close, and you're mm-hmm. just working on strength in that. And you can be as creative as you want with it.
Yeah, but that's a really good answer as to why you're even asking the questions. I try to counsel those who are mentoring is, you want to, every single word that comes out of your mouth during that eval should be for a reason. And you just gave a great example as to how to actually put that into play, which is, you're asking questions because depending upon their answer, it's going to take you down a different road, either totally in terms of treatment or with the nuance of the higher level exercises. It also builds a very credible spiel. And I think that's very important. When you get the athlete, especially the higher level guys who have probably bounced around and seen a number of clinicians, if you can create a story and a theory as to exactly why they're feeling what they're feeling, that stuff that they mention in the subjective, let's say with layback or with ball release, can then become a part of the narrative. You then explain to them as to why they're feeling what they're feeling and how you're going to fix it and how they're going to fix it. So I think it really creates this beautiful picture, and it's clear that you're not parsing words and just shooting the breeze as you make these conversations. It's actually for a point. Moving along further in your initial evaluation, talk to me about strength testing. How do you test them? How is it different than your standard shoulder screen, if it is?
So normally when I'm, and again, manual muscle testing, like we know, is super arbitrary, super subjective, you know, testing left and right side, getting a sense of just strength, but also like endurance. So like, I'll hold it for a little bit longer. So I'm going to do, you know, a basic, especially for rotator cuff, neutral position, they're seated, ER, IR. And again, you're assessing with pain with all these structures. Usually that's fine. If they're having symptoms, usually you're going to get it a 90-90, but I'll do ER, IR, and neutral by their side. I'll do it in a 90-90 position. I'll do it in a scaption position. I'll also even do it on their stomach and in prone. So I'll get a sense of IR in supine, ER in prone, all things like that. I'm also looking at, I'll have them on their back.
Why do you do it in both? Why do you do it in both?
Both supine.
Supine and prone, yeah.
Just to get a sense of, right, when they're in supine, their scap is stable. It's on a hard surface, so it has a sense of stability. So Sometimes, you know, if there's a scap deficit or scap weakness or poor, you know, scapulohumeral rhythm or scap control, you might see that more when they're on in prone. It's also going to be a harder position for them to recruit rotator cuff. So you might see compensations, like, especially if they struggle with ER, you know, ER strength or ER range of motion, you might see rhomboids kick in for scap retraction. You might see upper track kick in to try to cheat. You might not get that in supine.
Yeah, no, I love that. I think that's totally worthwhile. It's also a good opportunity to see what this gap is doing, like you're saying, like how are they compensating? So you see that in prone. It also gives you an opportunity to help their scapula. I call it a scapular placement test, and we'll get into special tests in a second. Mm-hmm. But if you can decrease their symptoms by doing the job of the rotator cuff and their scapular stabilizers with the therapist's hand, that can go a long way to say, hey, if your scap stabilizers were just doing their job, look, you would be stronger and you would have less pain. If indeed it's a positive test, meaning the symptoms go away when you place and hold scap. So I think there's some wisdom there. Are you doing this all manual muscle testing? Do you wish you had a handheld dynamometer? How else would you test it? True Sports Physical Therapy is growing like wildfire. We have 14 locations, soon to be more. We are throughout the state of Maryland. We're in Pennsylvania, in Lebanon, in York, Pennsylvania, as well as in Delaware, in Newark and Wilmington, Delaware. Like I said, so many more practices to come, and we always need outstanding sports physical therapists. Our treatment style is unique. We are one-on-one with your athlete for 45 minutes every single session. You do the entire treatment. You do the entire evaluation, and they are in state-of-the-art facilities where you have room to run, throw and jump and really get your athlete all the way back to on the field and better and stronger than they were. We also have outstanding salaries, comp structures, bonus abilities, 401ks, as well as a very strong continuing education offering, including in-house continuing education. And we're looking for you. Now is the time, as we are growing like crazy. Just shoot your resume over to Yoni, Y-O-N-I, at True Sports PT, or shoot us a DM and we will hit you back. We will get you in for our unique, tried and true interview process and really make a determination that this is the right place for you to grow your career and get your athletes better than ever. We can't wait to hear from you.
I do right now do it all just with my hands, manual muscle testing. Handheld dynamometer would be nice, because then you could see obviously rotator cuff strength, things like that. It is hard when comparing numbers, if you're going to go right side versus left and or dominant arm versus non-dominant arm, because that non-dominant arm is going to be weaker, sure, especially if this is your first time seeing that athlete. So you don't really know what their baseline was. You just know that it's either weaker or it's about the same, things like that. Yeah. Naturally, you're going to know that dominant arm is going to be stronger than the other dominant arm, especially with rotator cuff and scap muscles in general.
So sometimes that's true. My pushback on that is we know that along a season, depending upon where you are in the season, the more you throw, the weaker your cuff gets. Yeah, which is counterintuitive. So a lot of times I'll see guys towards the end of the season and their dominant arm external rotation force output is actually lower. than their non-dominant. So I think it's still worth testing. You can also use a Tyndek for this. We've gotten pretty creative with how you set that up, whether it be in supine or whether you be in a half kneel position.
Half kneeling.
Yeah, to mimic those and then also look at rate of force development because they might have the strength, but how quickly are they kicking it on? So I think there's what to dive into there. I would encourage everyone listening, if you don't have a Tyndek, get a Tyndek now, just so you can compare. It's a great visual feedback to create buy-in and then train around as you're rehabbing these things. Cost you $100. It's probably a good investment. Okay, so if that's your manual muscle testing, you talked about ranges of motion. Are you using a goni at any point? Are you actually measuring them like they taught you at LBC?
I will use a goni if I'm like, oh yeah, that's a big deficit. What are we at? Mm-hmm. If not, I will eyeball it, and my LBC professors will not love me for that.
Yeah.
Just because I've seen a ton of shoulders, and this isn't to like toot my own horn. You can get a sense of where they're at and where they need to go, especially in the thrower and things like that. Naturally, as long as you know that total arc is super, super close, then you're going to be good. But if you see an extreme deficit, like if you're lacking a ton of external rotation, let's measure it. Let's look at your IR. Oh, you're 30 degrees off. This could be a reason why your shoulder's bothering you because you don't have the range of motion or the structural support to even throw right now. You're stuck at 90 or 95. And as a pitcher, that's not good.
Sure. And I think also it's an opportunity to give you an exact number and then create buy-in or show them a difference, right?
Right. That patient knows, oh, I only have 9 degrees of external rotation range of motion, 30, 35 degrees short of total range. I need this right now, right?
Yeah.
Work on mobility, but then make sure you're also strengthening in those ranges because they've never been there.
Yeah.
Or they haven't been there in a while.
Okay. So that makes a lot of sense. So now I'm assuming I'm going to hear about special testing. What do you do? How much, I guess, emphasis do you put on your special tests?
In a super aggravated shoulder, if you get one in the thrower, I mean, 9 times out of 10, everything you're going to do is going to be painful. So you have to take that with a grain of salt. I'm looking at rotator cuff special testing. I'm looking at labrum special testing. Those are the big ones that you're going to see. Sometimes you're going to see some bicep tendonitis. So, testing for that.
Do you care? Hey, I got a positive speeds and a negative empty cam. So I say to the athlete, this is clearly long head of the bicep tendonitis, but is it going to change what you do?
No, it's not going to change at all. I think the biggest thing that if you're going to do that special testing is obviously see what structures are involved. You're going to get a good taste of that, but you're already going to be able to tell based on a basic assessment. But if it's something major, like, oh yeah, we definitely have a massive labral tear or stuff like that, or if they're having massive multi-directional instability in their shoulder and things like that, maybe they've tried PT in the past and have done it, and it just hasn't, hasn't been picked up. But from a rehab standpoint, none of those tests are going to change, in essence, what I'm going to do or what we're going to do. It's all going to be close to the same, really.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I thought. And then you're going to send them home with a home exercise program, right? How do you determine what you give them? How many do you give them? Walk me through your prescription of that.
So obviously what I'm going to give them is going to be dependent upon what I'm going to see. Usually it's an issue, especially in your younger athletes, but even in your, higher level guys, it's an issue with, rotator cuff strength, usually like that end range stability type things, as well as scap control. Obviously too, like what we're going to give them is going to be based on what they have access to and what they have need. Baseball players are usually always going to have bands and J bands. So usually that's something that I know they're going to have. And I discuss that with them. You know, what do you have at home? Do you have access to your gym? No, you do. Great. So bands are going to be great, especially for your younger athletes. So right away, I like to give them some form of rotator cuff isometric just to get that shoulder in a good position, whether they're having pain or whatnot. It's just going to be a good primer. So usually I'm giving like a uppercut hold, or I'll add like an uppercut hold with a turn. So then they're getting scap on the turn. Mm-hmm. From another strength standpoint, I'll also give, and you'll pick this up when you're looking at, let's say, like their scapulohumeral rhythm. And this is along the lines of bands, like a banded T. But what I'll add with that is make sure a lot of times you're going to see cueing, you're going to see upper trap activation, cue kind of center, but I'm also going to add in that retracted position, kind of like these lower half snow angels. So they're able to kind of work down, help bring their scap back and in, or from that abduct in an upwardly rotated position to a more neutral position where we need. So when they're raising up or getting into layback, if they're not already swung out.
And how much pain, I guess, let me ask you this. Where are you telling the athlete they should feel these things? And how do you respond if they're feeling some of it in their with their symptomology?
So your rotator cuff exercises, anything like we're doing with that, you should just feel it along the path of that muscle building the tendon. So good cue for me is like, do you feel that in the backside of your shoulder? A lot of the times what you'll get, especially if someone's having, like let's say a posterior shoulder pain or anterior shoulder pain, when they're doing a rotator cuff exercise, they may start feeling like, I feel the front of my shoulder, I feel pain there. Yeah. And that's usually because that shoulder is sitting in an anterior related position to the glenoid and it's rounded. So a lot of times, like if you're just doing basic like dumbbell ER or sideline ER or banded ER tubing in neutral, that shoulder is just kind of like internally rotated and position, you know, anteriorly. So they're just kind of stressing those anterior structures, that bicep tendon. They might even feel like their biceps doing work. So getting them to cue into a more neutral position. And a lot of that's just like we talked about, like that, how that scap is sitting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So and gently getting those shoulders back. Now let's feel it. And then 9 times out of 10, that's, you're like, okay, I feel the backside of my shoulder. I feel it there now.
Yeah. And if you cue them on, let's say, retracting their shoulder blades or putting their shoulder blades in their back pocket, getting humerus in a neutral position, and they still feel something anterior. How are you coaching them around that or through that?
For me, I'll give them that 3 out of 10.
Okay.
Cut off. Anything more than that, it's probably doing, you know, slightly more damage than good. I mean, if it's a 4, you have that conversation, but if it's like a 7 or an 8, all right, let's find something new that will actually be able to feel your rotator cuff or your scap and stuff like that, where we're not getting excessively high pain levels.
Yeah. And where do you go for that? Just give me some other options, because I think therapists just kind of get stuck with, well, we're still going to do it, or we're going to do it with less intensity. Where do you go from there?
So if you're getting consistent anterior shoulder pain when you're doing like that neutral tubing, like if it's a very young athlete or base, you know, they have a low training age and we still can't get it and things like that, I think putting them in a sideline position, so now their arm can just rest on, you know, their trunk, putting them in a sideline position on the table, kind of grab their shoulder and their scap and kind of move them back into that position. So one, they know how that feels. So they have a sense of direction versus you just talking words and, you know, squeeze the pencil. Like that's a big cue in PT. Like you have a pencil in between your shoulder blades, have them feel that. Then you can have them, all right, now pushing my hand that, all right, now this is the position that you're going to be in, you know, that neutral position with your scap, neutral position with your shoulder. Now they're in sideline. Now I'm just pushing down on their wrist. They're in ER. Let's hold this. Okay.
Yeah.
Now you can kind of get a better sense. You're limiting degrees of freedom. They're kind of in sideline. They're not worrying about an external movement. They're just kind of holding and you're able to guide them in a better position.
Yeah.
That goes well. I feel my cuff. Okay, let's add a little bit of weight here, but let's stay in the same position. Let's do a hold. Yeah. If that goes well, then let's just try the dumbbell. But I think if you're just blasting, oh, we're going to do it anyway because this is like a good rotator cuff exercise, I know this works, and they're still having high pain levels, I think you're just doing them a huge disservice because you're just adding insult to injury, and you're not going to get what you want out of that one, that session, or that plan of care if there's no change in, you know, in direction.
Yeah.
And the athlete's going to begin to question, like, my shoulder still hurting really bad. Right. Might be worse because now it's more inflamed. What are we doing?
Yeah. Yeah. I think another thing you could do is use electric stim here. I think it's terribly underutilized in the overhead population. I think we go crazy with it with quads, but do you see a role for it in stimming rotator cuff?
I do. I will use it as like that last step. Like if I regress and it's still nothing, all right, let's slap pads on it. Boom. Now that's definitely going to help them get some activation, feel better and things like that. And then they can get a sense. So I will use it, but it's going to be kind of more down my line of regressions for me at least.
Okay. All right. I want to ask you about beginning to move fast. I'm assuming you're going to start in neutral. You're going to progress into 90-90. Then you're going to start thinking, okay, how do I get this arm ready to move at a higher velocity? So enter the world of pre-plyometrics, plyometrics. Can you walk me through how you think about that, how you dip your toe in those waters, and then how you progress them all the way back to a mount?
So, yeah. So I may take a different approach with plyos for my overhead athletes and things like that. Obviously, the super basic route is once you build up their strength, they have some tissue capacity, they're able to generate force, they're able to stop force, you know, those basic buckets. Your basic progressions are just going to be like your two-arm plyos into your one-arm plyos. For me, I like to start mixing in some of those things, especially before one-arm plyos, with our weights and our training and generating force. So for me, I might start early on and I'll be able to get a sense of whether that shoulder is ready to start from with. If I'm pairing like a dumbbell bench or a dumbbell neutral bench, I might pair that with like a plyo pushup, both assisted with a band or overspeed, being the band on their back, right? And they're just generating force. They're taking force through that shoulder. I might also do it with like scap work with like rowing. Like I might do an incline bench row. And then what we're doing next, we have lighter weights and we're rowing and dropping and catching and things like that and coming up fast. All of those progressions, like with those weights, can be for anything, whether it be like the arms. I think arms are super not trained in baseball guys and in throwers and things like that. So same thing with curl, you know, bicep curl variations and tricep variations, all of that. That's how I start to prep, like, all right, they're able to handle this. There's no real flare-ups, things like that. Then we're going to progress into a little bit more dynamic med ball work, two arms.
Okay.
Whether that just be standing overhead, throwing down, kneeling overhead, throwing down, adding rotation to it up against the wall. Maybe I'm going to do like a shuffle rotational med ball toss into the whirl. Any two-arm variation that I can come up with or think of that's going to be high velocity, high effort, things like that, all goes well. Then we're going to progress to single arm. Single arm for me is going to be somebody like the standard med ball stuff you see, where it can just be overhead slamming down just to prep the shoulder. But then it's going to get into more of like your plyo balls at the wall and things like that, both from a throwing standpoint, reverse throws. I know reverse throws kind of get a heat on Instagram and things like that. I think they're just good in nature just to prep the shoulder and things like that. But for me, it's going to start in what we're doing in the rate room, progress to two-arm variations, single-arm variations, and then all goes well, we're going to cut them loose.
Okay.
And let them start throwing. And usually that first throwing session's with me. The first couple are going to be with me.
Okay. And what does that look like? How many reps? What type of effort? What type of distance?
So usually what I'll do is when they start getting into those one-arm plyos and they're doing that for a couple of sessions or a couple of weeks, depending on, you know, how they're looking or their symptoms and things like that, some of their weighted balls at the wall are going to be just, you know, volume count of whether it be 20 throws, you know, 20 throws once, maybe then we progress to 20 throws two times, you know, the next time with the break in between. Once they get through that, once they're with me, you know, that, you know, first step, usually I'm going about 25 throws at 40 or 50 feet, 50% intensity. That is super hard to gauge as a thrower. Yeah. It's super hard to slow your body down. One kid I'm rehabbing right now has, I believe it's a, I don't know the exact name of it. It's through Driveline, I believe. It goes on his forearm and he can, you know, see how much intent he's going based on velocity of his arm. So he knows like, all right, I topped out at 89, 50% is about here. It's all good and dandy, but in like in a perfect world, you know, whether you're able to tolerate that right away, you know, is a topic for a different day. But usually 50%, it's a light, like you're just playing catch, light toss, don't worry about anything. The only job is to get through this. And I'll do about 20, 25 throws two times that first session. So about 50.
Okay. Another way, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's great if they have that objective measurement. It is worth pointing out that throwers are notoriously poor at understanding what type of effort they're putting in. They're always putting in more effort than they let on. It's just the way it, like our brains are built. So it's worthwhile trying to get us as objective as possible. Another thing you could do is go out to distance and just ask for different arcs of motion on the ball.
Right.
And so the straighter it is, the more intense going to be behind it. The more force is going to be generated through the shoulder. So I think that's worth thinking about. It's worthwhile noting that the med ball stuff, we know, number one, we know by and large it increases velocity, just the use of a med ball program. Number two, we know that it increases ranges of motion. And most likely that is where your increased velocity is going to come from. So if you have a guy who is hypomobile, using weighted balls to increase ranges of motion, I would call it dynamic ranges of motion, is a really positive intervention. It makes a lot of sense. You want to be careful with those guys who are hypermobile and don't have the control, because they're not going to gain that control necessarily by doing things like weighted ball tosses. That's where your tubing comes in. That's where your end range holds, like that FRC stuff that you were describing, in prone, coming up into their peel off positions, would be worthwhile. So I think there's
a really lot there. Sorry to cut you off. I think you make a really good point of.
Dude, you can always cut me off. You can always cut me off with that. Let me interrupt you. You're making a great point. Yeah, go ahead.
You make a really good point in helping, like using med balls and that dynamic velocity stuff to increase ranges of motion. Because when we normally think about, like, you know, a lifting standpoint, the whole objective is just like to move that weight. So it's right. And throwing, if you're super stiff or super rigid or super, you know, angst up or jacked up, you're not going to be able to achieve those high levels of range of motion. So I feel when you're lifting and you're trying to, you know, increase, you know, range of motion through weights or whatever, you know, you're doing, I think sometimes the athlete can struggle with that because they're just so focused on trying to move the weight that they forget the task. Whereas when you break that down and you're, you know, doing med ball work, like med ball work is fun. You get to move something fast. You get to throw something. Like that's the whole reason they're there. They kind of don't really think about it and almost let it happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that that's really worthwhile. It becomes very task dependent, right?
Right.
And that can be a beautiful thing, especially with the pitcher. So going along that train of thought, at what point, if ever, do you start breaking down a pitcher's mechanics? Do you start looking at his lower half? When are you comfortable migrating away from the affected joint?
Hey guys, quick pause and a quick shout out to this new masterclass that we just launched here at True Sports Physiotherapy. Myself and Dr. Tim Stone put together a masterclass of ACL rehab, and we call it From Table to Turf. And the reason we call it that is because it's going to teach you exactly how to get your athlete all the way from post-op day one with the nitty-gritty of regaining all of that range of motion, with the tips and the tricks that we use here at True Sports Physiotherapy that gets our athletes better, faster, and stronger. And that's early. And then how do you progress that athlete all the way onto the field with a ball in their foot or a stick in their hand or whatever their sport is, and teach them how to accelerate, how to decel, how to change direction, and all the mechanics that go in there. What drills do we use to get our athletes exactly where they need to be, back on the field and even better than before injury? And I want you to sign up for that class. Now, you can find it on our website. You can shoot us a direct message and just say, hey, send me the course. It's right now on sale, so make sure you sign up now. It is fully accredited to get you all of your continuing education hours. Sign up for the True Sports Masterclass ACL from table to turf. Thanks, guys.
So once we get to that throwing phase, that return to throw program, and you know they're able to handle like those first two or three sessions with ease, I'm comfortable to now. We're still going to get our shoulder work. We're still going to get our arm work, scap, like all that. But now we're also going to be throwing in that core. And for me, a basic, you know, measurement or you know test, if you will, is let's start seeing how you can move your pelvis. So between anterior tilting, pelvic tilting, rotation, you'd be surprised at how many guys can't really do that.
Yeah.
As well as like high level guys, and that is something that in the throwing world, as we know, is crucial. Throwing is a very, you know, a kinetic chain movement. It starts in the lower half in the legs, comes through your core, and then ends in your arm. If there's any kink in that, especially in your core stability and your pelvic, you know, ability to rotate and tilt and things like that, you're going to place so much stress on the smaller muscles and smaller joints of your arm, including your shoulder and your elbow. And especially with a guy who has like countless shoulder injuries or countless elbow injuries, there's usually something that's being missed along the way.
Yeah. So when is it that you start to look there, and when, how far down the chain do you go?
So I'm going to look there honestly on my first exam that I'm going to do, just to get assessment of how they're moving their pelvis and things like that. When we're going to start going that route with, you know, drills and exercises and things like that, is once we start like that playing catch day, you know, whether it be a couple weeks down the road, basing, you know, on how they look or whatever the case may be, maybe they're a post-op, I'm going to start when they start to throw. That's going to be programmed into our sessions, and we're going to start working on that. Whether it's a full session of us doing dissociation work, you know, core stabilization, anti-extension work, or it's a split session, it's going to start when they are able to start throwing, because now I know their shoulder has a good baseline level of strength. We're at a point where we, you know, can throw or do our throwing program on our own, obviously checking in with me, where I know we're not going to have too many issues or things like that. So that's usually when I'll start mixing in that stuff once I know that they're at a good base of shoulder strength.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. I think people are way too quick to migrate away from the affected limb and away from the, let's call it the insulting structure. You got to clean up rotator cuff and shoulder mechanics first. If you don't, you're never going to come back to it, right? But once they've cleaned that up, starting to look at pelvis, starting to look at hips, starting to even all the way down towards ankles and how they do with inversion, eversion, things like that, is worthwhile. But you got to clean up the other stuff first, I think. Yes. Would be my bias. Okay, that was a whirlwind of information going through your evaluation. I loved hearing about your plyo progressions. I think there's a lot of gold there. You didn't say the words yada, yada, yada once. I thought it was going to be a podcast full of you saying yada, yada. So good work on that.
Did I say that a lot?
No, I don't want to get into it. Maybe, maybe not. Let's go to rapid fire. Try not to say yada, yada. Ready?
Oh,
the Eric Cressy rapid fire round. Here we go. Okay, if you had to choose one Yankee, the greatest Yankee, Aaron Judge or Derek Jeter?
I'm going with Jeter.
Why?
Because I grew up with Jeter.
Yeah, but he's a dirtball, dude. He's a dirtball.
Not that I didn't grow up with Aaron Judge. I just remember watching him as a kid, the captain. The old announcements of him walking up when he went flying into the stands. I'm going with number two. I had a number two jersey.
Ugh. Okay. Where does A-Rod fit in that?
I respect it. I like A-Rod. Okay. I like A-Rod.
So you appreciate dirt balls. That's what you appreciate. Clearly, you value that.
I'm from New York. I mean,
brutal. I'll tell you who I do appreciate. He doesn't get enough love is David Wells. Boomer Wells, I just read he spent $35,000 on a Babe Ruth hat and wore it in a game when he pitched for the Yanks and paid the fine because it wasn't team issued. So don't forget about David Wells, a great Oriole, I might add. Okay, what is the next course you're taking?
Oh, I am actually going to – course or conference, does it matter?
Same yeah, thing? No, I'll take either.
I'm actually going to a speed conference at the University of Pittsburgh in a few months with Les Bellman is going to be a lead coach. There's a ton of coaches. So I'm super excited with that.
Dude, I got to go there with you. That sounds awesome.
I think it's June 1st and June 2nd.
Is one of those days Saturday?
You know it is.
Damn it, Harnett. Okay, maybe I'll show up for the Sunday portion.
You could do a half day. They do offer half day tickets.
Okay, I'm in. Count me in for that. What is the biggest myth about outpatient sports PT?
The biggest myth about outpatient sports
PT? Yeah, don't repeat the question. Just give me an answer, Harnett.
Yeah, I think you stumped me on this one.
No, I'll give you my answer to give you a second to think. My answer is that all outpatient sports clinics are mills, where you're treating 3 or 4 patients an hour. I think that's a total myth. You can definitely find ones that are treating on the hour or 45 minutes. Try to find those would be my advice. What's your myth?
I think a big myth would be in relation to the facilities, expecting a certain facility to look a certain way, 15 different tables, ultrasound, hot pads, things like that, versus facilities that look like a college weight room.
Yeah, and to piggyback on that, I think the thought is you have to have things like a Proteus or a Cybex machine or an Alter G. If I had a nickel for every time a patient called me and said, hey, do you guys have an Alter G? Because I'm coming back from an ACL. My doctor said I need to have an Alter G. I just think it should be far more focused on the time your therapist has with you and the quality of therapist that is being provided to you should be what you're focused on when building a facility, when looking as a patient. I think that is far more important than the gadgets. Oftentimes, by the way, I've seen NFL organizations have DARI systems and these unbelievable motion capture analysis, and it's just collecting dust. They have no idea what to do with that data. So finding a facility that is a beautiful mix of both, I think, goes a really long way. Okay, other last tidbits or closing things that you think are important to hit for all those listening?
When it comes to baseball and treating shoulders or in general?
Yes.
So a lot of the times, and I hear it all the time, you know, shoulders are scary or I'm uncomfortable treating the shoulder. Break it down to your basics, especially in a throwing athlete. Get a really good subjective. I think hunkering down and figuring out where they're experiencing pain in the position of their throwing is crucial. And if you don't know much about throwing your baseball, ask someone, learn it, watch the game, get involved in it, because it's going to be so much easier. So get a really good subjective. Find out whether it's a mobility or stability issue. Crush your basics, because if you don't have the basics, then you're not going to be able to progress to whatever goals they want to achieve and things like that. And don't rush that. Don't rush those basics. Build up a good capacity of strength. Build up a good capacity of tissue tolerance between force production and deacceleration. Once you're good there, look at the rest of the chain.
Yeah, I love that. That's really encapsulated beautifully. So, Harnett, thanks so much for hopping on. Thanks for not doing that residency. And sticking with us, our patients have done nothing but benefit from those decisions. So appreciate you dearly. Diamond Doctor 14 on Instagram. Reach out to John, give him some feedback on how he did today. Reach out to us, True Sports PT on Instagram. Let us know how we did, how I did, what you want to hear from, what you want to hear more of, who you want to hear from. We're all ears. Guys, thanks so much for listening. Harnett, thanks for your time, man.
Appreciate you. Go Yankees.
This podcast is different than any other podcast out there. We are really focused on bringing you usable techniques, usable strategies to make you a better therapist tomorrow. So listen to all these guests that we get on here because they are at the forefront of this profession. They're going to teach you how to get your athletes better, how to get them better quicker, how to put them back on the field stronger than they were before injury, with a whole bunch of nuance, little trips, tips, techniques, how we coach things, how we cue things, and how we just make you a better clinician. That's why you should listen to this podcast. That's why this podcast is different than anything else out there on the market. Can't wait for you guys to continue to learn with us, to teach us, to give us feedback, and let us create the ideal product for you for Sports Physical Therapy Podcasts.